Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. It was a good response. Also wanted to thank you for your responsiveness yesterday. I appreciate getting response from the audience. And also, you could look at it this way. You might come here expecting that I'm supposed to have something to present, and I think that's a fair expectation. But I've also found that when you are willing to respond, you're also giving me the opportunity to learn things that I may not have thought of. So there may be times when I'm looking for a particular thought and going to go with a certain flow of thought, and your thoughts may not necessarily parallel mine, but you should not feel that you have to provide one right answer. When I'm asking for a response, there's usually not always just one right answer. There's other ways that it could be answered. So I want you just to feel that freedom to respond as you would feel is appropriate. So a little bit of a quiz. What was our perspective yesterday? Grace. Okay. And now we're going to go through Philippians chapter by chapter. And so we're going to go through, you could say, I took the text from Philippians chapter 1 yesterday, and we talked about it more as a theme, and we related it to some of Philippians. Today we're going to start in chapter 1, and now we're going to go chapter by chapter for the rest of the week. So the perspective for today is the suffering perspective. How do we view suffering? What is the meaning of suffering in the Christian life? And so Philippians is a very good book to help us understand or to get a right perspective on suffering. One of the questions that is very commonly asked by skeptics, or maybe even your neighbor or interactions, I know it's one of the most commonly asked questions to CAM's billboard team. And there's variations of that question, but it goes something like this. Why do bad things happen to good people? Or why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? And all of us in the human experience, it's very common when we're in the midst of suffering to ask the question, why? Do you think it's wrong to ask the question why?
No.
Why do you say it's not wrong to ask the question why?
Because it shows that we're looking for trying to learn.
Okay. Very good. So when we ask the question why, there could be all kinds of motivations behind that. But just asking the question why is not wrong. Because if we are asking the question why and we're asking it to God, did we go to the right source?
Yes.
Are we asking the question to the right person? And what happens when we have questions in our life and we refuse to engage with that emotion? We're trying to shut it down. And when we try to shut down something that's painful or important in our life, does that fix it when we shut it down? And so when we read a book like Job, or even a lot of the Psalms, do we see whys in there? There's a lot of whys in there. They're trying to understand their experience. And what did we say yesterday about perspective? What we see, our perspective is our reality. For us, that is what life is. And so when we're dealing with this issue of suffering or God, why did you bring this into my life? What did I do wrong to deserve this? We're asking that question. We're having a dialogue with God. If we're having a dialogue with God, we're going to the right place to deal with our deepest and hardest questions. And so when we look at the idea of suffering, what's sort of behind that as we think about suffering is there meaning? Is there purpose in suffering? Or we could say it another way, can good come out of bad things? What seemed to be bad or hard or difficult? I use the term bad in a very generic sense. And so, if you were to think about all of human history, who would you name as someone in human history who probably suffered the greatest injustice of any human being? Jesus. So Jesus suffered more injustice than anyone in human history. Now, why do we say that he suffered more injustice? Give me some reasons. Let's back this up a little bit. Excuse me? He didn't deserve it. And why do we say he didn't deserve it? Just go a little deeper. He was sinless. So if anybody didn't deserve it, who didn't deserve it? Jesus. Because if there's any person who could be perfect and sinless and didn't deserve mistreatment, it was Jesus. Now, did his suffering have meaning? Did it have a good purpose? And so when we think about there's Jesus Christ, he's the example in all of human history as the one who suffered the greatest injustice. And yet as we look at suffering through the lens of Jesus Christ, we can say it had meaning and purpose, and it even has meaning and purpose in our lives. And so what happened 2,000 years ago is still relevant, still inspires us today, still changes lives. Did you ever think about it from the aspect of the fact that what happened so long ago, which was a travesty of justice, somebody didn't deserve that. But the story about that took place keeps changing lives for the better year after year. Do you think it's possible for your life to make a difference? Last evening we heard about a circle, and there's always people in your circle. Everyone has people in their circle. And you're going to always have a time in your life where you're going to deal with some hardship or suffering or difficulty, and there's always going to be other people in your circle that are going to deal with the same thing. That's called the reality of life. And in answering this question, I've been asked this many times, and one of the things I do in answering the question, because people want to go, well, if there's a God, why would he would allow such? So I put the question back to them and I say, okay, let's suppose there isn't a God then. How does that solve your problem? Does it? Does your unbelief make all your suffering and problems go away? No, it does not. It does not change the reality of your life. So now I've removed God from my life, I've removed him from my mind, and I still have to deal with suffering, right? Because that's a part of reality, that's a part of my life. But now comes back, I come back to the same question, I still ask the question, why? I'm still asking the question, why? And I've removed God from my life, and now I'm going to try to answer the question, why? How do I answer that question? Is there meaning and purpose in this after I've removed God? Because once I've removed God and there's no plan, there's no order, there's no someone involved in the event, what am I left with? Nothing but an accident, right? Random. Is there any meaning in that which is totally accidental or random? And so I have the same problems and I have less answers. And so even though we can't fully answer the question many times, why has God allowed this to happen? Removing God from that experience does not answer the question why. And the question why will still remain. If we accept in the difficult that even though I can't answer the question why, perhaps who can answer the question why? So that means that even though I don't know the reason, out there, there may still be a reason. Just because I don't know the reason doesn't mean that God does not have a reason. And so suffering has meaning and purpose. And so when we face hardships, we're often dealing with two possible outcomes. We face a hardship. And when we read the Bible, we see a hardship sometimes that we have three people and they're threatened to be cast into the fire, and they are cast into the fire, but those three people are, that were cast into the fire, they are safe or delivered, right? They're delivered. So they had a hardship. They didn't know they were going to be delivered, right? So it was a very difficult decision because God didn't tell them the answer ahead of time. So the decision for them was just as hard as if the outcome would have been different. But they trusted God that there had to be a reason, even though they didn't understand the reason. And they went into the fire, and God delivered them. Now we have other accounts in Scripture where we don't see deliverance, right? And in the and those that paid the ultimate price, we call them what? Martyrs. They give their life. And so here we have this book of Philippians. Does anyone know how the gospel first went to Philippi? Who went to Philippi first? Go ahead.
Paul.
And where did he end up when he went to Philippi? Prison. And what happened when he was in prison? What was his outcome? Sang and prayed and God delivered. And so the one outcome was deliverance, right? So now Paul is writing this letter. Paul's actually in prison when he's writing this letter. He's in prison in Rome. And so as he's writing to these Philippians, the Philippians remember that when Paul came and planted the church, he was cast into prison, then he was delivered. And so when you have deliverance in your life one time, you think if I'm delivered one time, it might happen again. But what happens if it doesn't happen again? Does that mean then because I wasn't delivered, my life, my suffering doesn't have meaning? And so you can see as Paul is writing this book, this letter to the Philippians, it could have been in their mind, well, God delivered them one time. Is Paul not singing? Or does Silas need to go there? Does it need to be a duo? Do they both need to sing? If they both sing, would he be delivered? Now, I realize I'm embellishing it a little bit, but the point is, that question, put yourself there. Human experience says that question would be, why doesn't God deliver? And so in the first time when God did deliver, God was showing a side of Himself, His mighty power, His ability to deliver. When God chooses not to deliver, but chooses to allow His servant to suffer, what might He be demonstrating in that scenario?
Grace.
I'm getting help from God that is beyond my own abilities. And because I accept that condition as being part of God's plan for my life, And I'm sitting here in prison and I'm writing a letter to other people who are not in prison, but who also have hardships. So if I get this letter and I'm in the middle of a difficulty and it comes from this fellow who's in prison, and I look at his problems and I look at my problems, and he's in prison, he doesn't know if he's going to live or die, but my problem is whatever it is, but I start to say, maybe my problem is not as big as his problem, and how would I respond in his situation? And his example, his attitude, is a great inspiration to me as I deal with my problems. And so Paul, as he is reaching out to these Philippians, we know that these Philippians were in a time of difficulty. Look at verse 30. Having the same conflict which he saw in me, and now here to be in me. In other words, they are also dealing with suffering. They might not be in prison, but they're dealing with suffering. Look at verse 28. And in nothing terrified by your adversaries. So the church is getting pressure. The church is getting a lot of pressure. And some of these believers are feeling the pressure. They don't know what's going to happen to them. But if Paul would have wrote to them, hey, when I was in your town, I got delivered. And now life is going well. I hope you guys can all experience what I experienced in deliverance. Do you think that would have been, do you think that'd be very encouraging for someone that's in the middle of a difficulty? Oh, yes, it could be encouraging in the aspect of, yeah, God is able to deliver. We get that. But what if he chooses not to deliver? How do I get through this? And so Paul is able to identify with them because he's also in prison. And Paul points things out that start to take place by people who are in prison because he's in prison. Verse 14. And many of the brethren in the Lord, waxing confident by my bonds, are much more bold to speak the word of God without fear. And so suffering, his suffering, is inspiring others to be more bold in preaching. Now, Paul has to deal with this whole thing in his own life about, is he going to live or is he going to die? And we see that in verses 20 and 21. He's asking some of these questions. Well, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. If I'm going to remain here, I could continue to work for the Lord. But if the Lord would decide to take me, that would be great because then I would no longer have to suffer here. And so either way, he's looking at this and saying, either way, I'm in the hands of the Lord, and I will accept whatever the Lord chooses to do with my life. Now, when you think about adopting that attitude towards suffering, first of all, I may have suffering or I may have hardship that's inflicted on me by other people. But if I look beyond the other people and say, ultimately, my life is in the hands of God. Okay? I'm not looking at my life as being in the hands of my adversaries. I'm looking at my life as being in the hands of God. And because it's in the hands of God, I don't fear. Because ultimately, God is going to make that decision. And when persecutors are trying to get their ends accomplished with people who are not afraid of death, their ends are never accomplished. Because a persecutor depends on fear in order to gain their objective. People that try to make difficulty or hardship in other people's lives are trying to manipulate, to control through the use of fear. When we have the right perspective concerning suffering, and we don't fear to suffer or we don't fear hardship. And I'm saying that by the grace of God, because humanly speaking, none of us will choose that. We all know that. That needs to be understood. If you go through the food line and you have a choice between something you like or you don't like, what do you pick? You pick what you like. Unless it's a matter of what you don't like is something you know you absolutely need. That would be the only reason that I can think of in a typical application. And so, yes, humanly speaking, of course we prefer the things that are pleasant. And there's nothing wrong with preferring the things that are pleasant. They're blessings from the Lord. But when there is hardship that goes beyond our choice, and we let that in the hands of the Lord, our perspective on life is influenced by our view of suffering. Now notice some of the things that take place in Paul. He's sitting in prison, he's writing this letter. Look at verse 2. Grace be unto you and peace from God our Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Do you think Paul had any struggles with feeling at peace about his situation? Do you think he had ever felt a need for God's grace? And yet, he is not focused on asking just for prayers for himself. He's conveying blessings to others when he's in the midst of suffering. I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. The first thing he's doing is he's thanking God for what he's doing in other people's lives. And when we're in the midst of a difficulty, and we're, just put it in the context of a child. When a child is hurt, who do they go to? Mom or dad. Probably even a little more mommy, right? Why do you think a child would typically go to a mother versus a father, if a young child, if they're hurt? Excuse me? A mother would be more tender, more apt to empathize with how the child is feeling. The father might be like, let's see, what do we need to do to fix this up in order to get you back on the road again? If you're doing chores, to finish your chores. You know, sometimes that's how we evaluate things. I remember sometimes when I was sick and my dad would say, you know, maybe what you need is work, sweat it out. And there's an aspect of truth to that. And actually we need the father and the mother balance in the child's life. Both of those are good. But the child typically gravitates towards the mother because the mother will tend to be more tender and have more empathy in the response. And so, as we suffer, we become more empathetic to other people's pain and difficulty. Why does God ask us to suffer sometimes? Because He's teaching us how to minister to other people who are suffering. And so Paul is reaching out. I'm sure he taught the Philippians to be thankful. But there's no better way to teach someone to be thankful than to see someone exhibiting thanksgiving when they're in the midst of difficulty. In the early church, this issue of persecution and suffering was a very real thing. And when you made a decision to follow Jesus Christ, and especially when you made a decision to be baptized, they looked at that, the pagan world looked at Christian baptism as the sign of no turning back. I'm not sure what all you do in your churches and how you administer baptism, but in our congregation and a lot of our fellowship of churches, the one question that is asked is, do you covenant with God in Christ Jesus to be faithful unto death? And in the early world, the early Christians, when you made a decision to be baptized, it was one thing to make a decision to follow Christ. But when you were publicly baptized, that was saying, that's a covenant. There's no turning back. And so many, after they were baptized, when it became known, is when they faced the real persecution. So we have an account in the Roman Empire. It was in the area of Carthage. There was a group of young people who were apprehended for their faith. I'm not sure if they were baptized yet or not, but they were considered catechumens. In other words, they were still receiving instruction. They were very new in faith. And that might have varied with some of the churches, how much instruction was received before baptism versus baptism and then instruction after baptism. And that's not the point. It's simply they were very new in faith. And of this group that were new in faith, there were two young ladies. One young lady was a slave. The other young lady was a noble woman, born into a noble, privileged, high-ranking member of society. The one young woman was pregnant, expecting soon to have a child. The other one just had a child and was nursing them. So they're brought into prison, and the slave's name is Felicitas, and the highborn lady was Perpetua. And Felicitas was the one who was pretty far advanced in pregnancy, and Perpetua was the one who had a nursing child. And the father of Perpetua, she had the nursing child, Because he was highborn, he was a high-ranking member of society, he came and pled with his daughter to give up her faith. He said, "You're throwing your life away. All of this suffering is for nothing. It doesn't need to be. You have a child. You should think about your child. Think about me as your father. Think of what you're doing to my reputation. Think of all the shame that you're bringing upon your family with this choice that you have made. We had status in society. You're ruining our status by the choice that you've made. Now you're here in this prison like a common criminal, an enemy of the state." The other lady that was expecting Felicitas, as she was in jail, it says, when the pains of labor seized her, this is the account that was written by the early Christian, when the pains of labor seized her in prison and she cried aloud for fear and anguish, the jailer said to her, "Thou art so much afraid and distressed now and criest aloud for pain. How then wilt thou behave when tomorrow or the day after you're going to be led to your death?" In other words, if you can't endure the pain of childbirth, how do you think you're going to be able to be a martyr? And Felicitas replied thus, "Now I suffer as a poor woman the punishment which God on account of sin has laid upon the female sex." Talking about travail and childbirth that was a result of Adam and Eve's sin. "But tomorrow I shall suffer as a Christian woman for the faith and the confession of Jesus Christ." In other words, the one is a natural suffering, but tomorrow I will suffer for my faith. And by these words, she sufficiently indicated that she had firmly and immovably founded her faith upon Christ, who never forsakes her own, even though they be in the midst of the fire and are consumed. God also especially strengthened her, so that she might be able to endure her sufferings. With reference to this, Tertullian, that's an early church leader, says, "Perpetua, the very strong and steadfast martyr, had a revelation or a vision of the heavenly paradise on the day of her sufferings, in the which she saw none but her fellow martyrs." And so God gave her that vision to strengthen her. They were both strengthened in their own way. And they were brought out, initially they were brought out into the arena for their death in their nakedness. It was supposed to degrade them for the amusement of the crowd. And the crowd asked for them to be clothed, knowing that they were representing a pure lifestyle. They were taken back in and they were given clothing. They were brought back out again. And they had what's called a heifer, would have been sort of like a cow that would have been trained to be wild to be in the arena, and turned the heifer on them. And they were both thrown and they were incapacitated, they were wounded. In fact, one of them, I believe it was Perpetua, literally passed out. And her fellow believers gathered around her and she came to again. And you ladies might have appreciation for this. And when she came back, she asked what happened. And they explained to her what happened. And she knew then that she was still alive. And she said, "So I'm still going to face my death." And they said, "Yes, your death is still coming." So she said, "Ask them if they will get me something that I can fix my hair." Showed a lack of fear. She said, "When I die as a martyr, I don't want to look like someone who is defeated. I want to look like someone who is ready and wants to go." And they allowed her to comb her hair. She met her death as a lady. The early church was really inspired about the accounts of these two young ladies. And in the churches in this territory, they would read the account of their martyrdom on a yearly basis. It's interesting that many times there are accusations made that the church does not recognize the value of women. The Gospels recognize the value of women. The Gospels show women having a very prominent part in Jesus' ministry. The early church also, yes, they had other martyrs. They had other male martyrs. But these two female martyrs became a tremendous inspiration. Think about it. What could be more difficult for a young mother than at the beginning of her life to think about, I'm going to bear a child. I should have mentioned that. The one who was pregnant, they allowed her to bear her child, and then she was taken to her death. To think that I will bear a child, bringing him into this world, and then I will face my death and not be able to raise that child. And the other one, I just had a child, and I'm still nursing it. And I must give it up and trust that God will, both of them had to trust that God would take care of their children. Tremendous test of faith. And they inspired many other Christians to be willing to suffer. And in this experience now, leading up, backing up a little bit, their jailers came to them and said, your date has been set. You're going to be martyred. But we're going to allow you to have some food. And they brought the food in, and the group of believers there said, well, if we have food, we can have a love feast. And so they held a love feast. Now, that word love feast might not connect with everyone here. The early church had what they called the agape meal. They would often eat the agape meal in connection with the communion service. When we look at John 13, we see that they were eating a supper. We know from the other Gospels that it was, that they, in the Jewish context, it was a Jewish Passover. But in the Christian context, it's not called the Last Passover, it's called the Last Supper. And John was the last Gospel written, and John refers to it as a supper. And so these young believers celebrated the Last Supper together. It shows the tremendous care that they had for one another. The desire for, before we leave this earth, to have the most close fellowship that we can have with one another. Now, when we hold communion, we hold it as a memorial to the death and suffering of Christ, or to memorialize His suffering. And in connection with memorializing His suffering, we are also to consider it a time of fellowship or close communion with one another. And we see that throughout this passage here, as Paul is talking about these believers here, he talks about how his bowels yearn for them and how he cares for them. And so we see how his suffering has increased his care of others. And it's only by the grace of God that that is possible, because normally, going back to the illustration of a child, when a child runs to his mother, what is the child concerned about? The pain that they're experiencing. And mother, because she feels for me, because she's tender-hearted, she is going to try to relieve my pain. Naturally, that's what we do. We want our pain relieved. In suffering for Christ, we see here Paul is concerned about the welfare of others. Suffering for Christ removes self and helps us to think about Christ and helps us to think about others. And when that is communicated, We are in the greatest attitude of fellowship. It's the fellowship of the sufferings of Christ. And so Paul, as he's talking to these believers, and you can read through this passage and you'll see how he's thankful for them. He enjoys their fellowship, verse 5. He speaks to them throughout this chapter here, showing his intense and intentional love. Verse 8, "For God is my record how greatly I long after you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ. From my innermost being, I desire fellowship and relationship with you." And in all of this, he's not saying one word about the difficulties or the pain that he's experiencing. He doesn't tell us if he's cold when he's writing this letter. He doesn't tell us if he's hungry when he's writing this letter. He's focused on them, and that's what the grace of God can do in a situation like that, when we suffer for Christ. When we face hardship or we face suffering, there are many times where we can be caught by surprise. We often hear the saying, you know, it doesn't take long for life to completely change for one of us. Something can happen in our life that completely changes the rest of our life. And we don't see it coming. But God is never caught by surprise. And so it's important to have an understanding that there's always meaning in suffering. So when hardship comes into our life without warning, and it catches us by surprise, we can be assured that it has not caught God by surprise. And God has a plan, God has a purpose, and God continues to work His purpose and His plan out in our lives. And then Paul goes on to say, he's in prison, he's a preacher of the gospel, and now he's in prison, he's not able to preach outside of prison, but he starts to talk about those other people who are preaching Christ. Verse 15, "Some indeed preach Christ even of envy and strife, some also of goodwill." So there's a variation in the motives. The one preach Christ of contention, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my bonds. Apparently in how they were using their ministry, they were trying to degrade Paul and they were trying to elevate themselves. It could have been something like this. We're not told what it is, but perhaps it was something like this. Yes, God protected Paul when Paul was living according to God's will, but he mustn't be living according to God's will now, because when he was living according to God's will, God took him out of prison. Now God is not taking him out of prison. God is letting him in prison. So Paul's in prison, but I'm out of prison. I'm under the protection of God. So apparently God wants me to preach. God wants you to hear me and does not want you to hear Paul. I don't know. But Paul is alluding to something here where other preachers were degrading him and trying to elevate themselves. Others maybe used it as an opportunity. Maybe Paul was popular, so now that he's gone, maybe I have an opportunity to be more popular, to be more respected, or maybe to have a stronger role in leadership. We're not told. It's just he doesn't call out names and he doesn't give specifics. He just says that there are many reasons why people can preach Christ. But he says this: "Nevertheless, I am glad that Christ is preached. What then? Notwithstanding in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached, and I therein do rejoice, yea, and will rejoice." Now I'd like to give a more common illustration, or maybe you'd say a more up-to-date, current, contemporary example of how this could play out. In our backgrounds, we would tend to discourage, and maybe to different levels, the involvement of Christians in sports. You know, what level should a Christian be involved in sports? Well, you know, if you go to a private school, you probably will play some softball. And so we'd say, well, there's a degree in which that is fine. And that's healthy for a child to get exercise. But when it comes to professional sports, we would say that there's better things that you can do with your life. And so I'm going to give an illustration from a real example in my life of an encounter that I had with a professional athlete. And so I'm using this as an illustration, but I want you to keep this in mind, keep this perspective. Paul also used illustrations of athletes in the Olympics of his time. We have that recorded in 1 Corinthians 9:24 to 27 and Hebrews 12:1. And he was not telling the believers to go out and become Olympians. That's not what he was saying, but he was using that as an illustration. And so I want to give you an account of something that happened in my life. I was went with my boss to a business conference in Pittsburgh. And because it was held in Pittsburgh, the event planners were trying to showcase some of the things that were part of Pittsburgh's history and things that maybe made Pittsburgh outstanding. And the business conference was for owners across the country, owners of facilities such as higher education, healthcare, and government facilities that regularly did construction work. And so to these events would come owners from across the country, owners representatives that do work similar to what I do, and then contractors would come and design teams would come, and they would have workshops to talk about different ways to execute, carry out construction projects. Some were very complex projects and lessons learned and things like that. So anyway, then they would often work into it some, I'll call it a sideshow. In other words, things that are just sort of to get people excited about attending this event. And so one of the things that they picked that was to be exciting for the people who were attending this event is they were doing a presentation and allowing this individual to speak who was an NFL, National Football League, Hall of Famer. His name was Mel Blunt. I don't follow football, never really did in my whole life. I didn't even know who he was. And I thought, well, fine. I know the Pittsburgh Steelers have their fans, and I know when I was young, the Pittsburgh Steelers had a very strong team. What I didn't know is that one of the reasons the Pittsburgh Steelers had a very strong team for a number of years was because of this individual who was going to present that afternoon. So I'm going to read to you a little bit what we know about this man now. I didn't know it then, but I'm going to give you some prep that I didn't have. This man, Mel Blunt, he was born in 1948. He was an American professional football player for the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was five times in the Pro Bowl or the Super Bowl, Pro Bowl. He's considered one of the best cornerbacks to have ever played in the NFL. He was, in fact, so good at and one of the most defensive cornerbacks that they actually passed a specific rule that would limit his ability to play. So essentially, it was nicknamed the Mel Blunt Rule. He had 57 interceptions in his career. He was in five Pro Bowls. He was named NFL's most valuable defensive player in 1975 and 76, 77, 1981. Four-time All-AFC selection and played in five Pro Bowls. I said Super Bowl, it's Pro Bowl. Anyway, all of that for whatever it's worth. It just, and he was a Hall of Famer. So this, I didn't know his history. But anyway, before he comes up on the stage, they gave some snapshots of his plays on the screen. Again, I said I don't know much about football. I watched that and I thought, well, I don't know that much about football, but I know enough to know that he is very good. And the first thought that crossed my mind is, These people are presenting him, and they're like, and let us show you, in case any of you don't know who he is or remember him. You know, I know some of you are younger, but this is the guy, and he's going to soon be here. And I wondered, like, with that type of introduction, how will he introduce himself? That was the thought that was going through my mind. And so he came out, 6'3". I think he was right around 70 years old. Stood straight and tall, very broad-shouldered, still very fit. And he looked over at that screen and he goes, "Yeah, it's almost hard for me to imagine now, having done those type of things. My life has moved on from that. And I'm here today not because of that, but because of what I want to tell you." Almost dismissive. What stands out in that introduction of himself?
Humility.
First thing that went through my mind. Second thing was, what is making this man so humble? He's being introduced as someone great. He's trying to dismiss that because he has another message that he wants to share. So he goes on and he begins, "Now football was a big part of my life." And he said, "It was very important to me in my early life." But he said, "I want to tell you a little bit about my early life." He said, "My father was a sharecropper farmer in Georgia." Does anyone know what a sharecropper is? Go ahead, someone, speak out. Okay, so a sharecropper is someone who doesn't own the farm, but they farm for a percentage of what is made off the crops. And so this man was a black man, and sharecropping became very prevalent in the South with the families who were formerly slaves. They were given farms to farm for the benefit of someone else, and they earned a portion. And so he grew up on a sharecropper farm. And he said, "My father taught me how to work." And so he said, "That's what began to make me the man that I am today, is the fact that I had a father." First of all, he said, "I had a father who was there for me. And he taught me how to work." And he went on as he described his life. He said, "My father was busy. They couldn't take me to football games." He said, "If I wanted to go to a football game, my father did not prevent me, but he said I would have to walk because he did not have time to take me. So he said, I would walk to and from." And so now I'm looking at the other people, and I'm saying the people are just, he has their 100% attention. And he was not an animated speaker. He was speaking very casually. He spoke sort of monotone. But you could tell his words and his bearing carried weight, and the people were paying attention. Well, as businessmen all like to hear stories about from rags to riches. And so this looks like this is going to be a good story. They might have been shocked by his humility, but now we have potentially a good story coming. So he tells us a little about his father, and he said, "Well, it's not just the work ethic that my father had to shape my life, but it was also the values that he had." And he said, "My father was a deacon in the church. And he was very concerned about what values got passed on to me." And he went on and he said, "I'll tell you why I'm here today." He said, "I grew up on a farm." And he said, "My first determination as I made money, is the first money that I wanted to invest, was to go and buy my family farm from the owners, so that our family would be able to have that legacy, that heritage, and all the memories of all the good values that we were taught on this place." And so he wasn't thinking about himself. He was thinking about what he could do for his family to take that stress out of their life. And so now I'm starting to think, he's humble. His first concern is for others. And I'm starting to think, has somebody else come into this person's life? Now remember, Paul says that there are some people who are going to preach Christ, and they may not necessarily have our motivations, our values, but nevertheless, I rejoice that Christ is preached. And so, by now, I'm looking around, and you could have heard a pin drop. People are glued to what this man is going to say. He said, football has made me financially successful. And he said, I played here at Pittsburgh. He said, it would not be right for me to use this money just on myself. I need to invest it back. I need to give it back. So he said, I thought about the fact that I had a father. I had a father who gave me values. And there are many young men on the streets of Pittsburgh who do not have a father in their life. There are many young men who do not have someone teaching them values. And I thought about where I learned. I learned because I had a father in my life and because we had a farm to work on. So he said, I bought a farm 40 miles from Pittsburgh. And I have young men on my farm. Now I'm 70 years old. Now I've done everything I can make a difference. These young men. They said, I'm not going to be here long. And I haven't found anyone to take my place. I am here today to ask you businessmen, who of you is willing to take one of my boys, mentor them, be a father to them, give them a job, help them to succeed? And he said, you're going to look back at me and say, that's not going to solve all Pittsburgh's problems. He said, I'm not asking you to solve all Pittsburgh's problems. I'm asking you to make a difference. One life. He said, you might say, well, what difference is it going to make in one life? He said, there's more than 12 businesses represented here. He said, Jesus took 12 disciples and changed the world. I'm asking you to take one man and make a difference in their life. Now, this illustration is not to advocate Christians being part of professional sports. That's not why I share this. But I am advocating professional athletes to have a life-changing encounter with Jesus Christ. That is what I saw that day. And in his own way, he related that. In his own way, he messaged that to that group. I gave you two accounts. One from many years ago in the early church of two young girls that made a difference. Did those young girls make a difference? They did. Those young girls made so much of a difference that the church leaders had to caution their members not to recklessly offer themselves up as martyrs because of the story of those young ladies who willingly gave their lives in martyrdom. Look what it says in verse 29. For unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake. Just as salvation is a gift, just as faith is a gift, just as grace is a gift, suffering is a gift. And the early church looked at suffering as a gift, and they counted it a privilege to be a martyr after hearing the testimony of those two girls. They wanted, church members wanted to suffer for Christ, to be counted worthy. I gave you the example of a more recent case. I only knew what I knew at the day in which I was there about Mel Blount. Since then, I've done some research. How did his farm get started? When he wanted his farm to be able to be used for this purpose, of course, he had to go through zoning and permitting. He faced a lot of opposition. He didn't say one word about it that day, the opposition that he faced. He faced that much opposition that the Ku Klux Klan showed up and began spreading flyers. And they said this, how long do you think it will be before one of those apes rapes one of your white women? Now, in my lifetime, my paths have crossed with two Klansmen at one time. And I can tell you that the language that was being used is language that Klansmen used. And back in that era, there was a rise of the Klan's operation. And he faced that, but he stayed the course. The state tried to offer him money, but he knew if he accepted money from the state, he's also going to have restrictions on his home. And he said this, "You can't buy me with 30 pieces of silver," is what he told the state when they offered money to help him. And so reporters came and they interviewed children. Here's what some of the children said. "Mr. Mel makes sure no one hurts us, and he wants us to change. He's trying to make sure we change. He's one of the only people that really cares." Another one said, "Mr. Mel helps me get away from all the bad stuff going on in my neighborhood. He treats us like he's our daddy. He treats us with respect." One of the Pittsburgh city councilmen said this, "I visited the farm and it's fantastic. I've been there and I've never seen anything like it." He never told us a word about what he suffered in order to live that dream of helping young men. But he made that sacrifice and his life made a difference. Now, I think it's fair to say that when Mel gave his presentation, he did not lift himself up. Who could we say that he lifted up as the example? Jesus. And Jesus said, "If I be lifted up, what happens? And if I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me." I'm not saying, and Mel wasn't saying, that he was the perfect example of a model Christian. But that day, he lifted up Christ. And it made a difference in the audience that was there. After it was over, I walked around and I talked to some individuals. I knew an individual that was a business development of a large company. I said to him, "What do you think about the presentation?" He said, If I don't learn anything else while I'm here," he said, "it was worth coming just to hear him speak." I walked around wherever there were clusters and I would stand there, act like I was busy doing something. I wanted to overhear the conversations. Because I'm sure they did not hear what they expected to hear. But a man who had suffered and given in order to help others, and then lifted up Christ, made a difference. And when he told his story, it made a difference. And it will in your life when you lift up Christ in spite of what God has chosen for you to suffer.
Thank you for listening to this message. We trust that it has been a blessing to you. If you would like additional sermons or a catalog, please visit our website at effortofministries.org. Call us toll-free at 855-557-7902 or write to us at Ephrata Ministries, 400 West Main Street, Suite 1, Ephrata, Pennsylvania, 17522. You are welcome to copy this message for free distribution. This ministry is supported by your donations. May the Lord Jesus bless you.